You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In her latest book, Anita Hill, now a professor of social policy law and women's studies at Brandeis University, looks at the roles racial and sexual inequality have played in home ownership and how the current housing crisis is threatening the possibility of the American dream for everyone. Her new book, Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding a Home, is published by Beacon, and Anita Hill was on our show in October to talk about it. I began by asking her, hasn't home ownership been a symbol of economic success and even equality in the African-American community since Reconstruction?
Absolutely, it has. I mean, ever since African-Americans moved out of the slave cabins, and people would be surprised that that didn't happen immediately after the wars, Civil War. But even since then, moving out of the slave cabins, as my forebears did, and moving into property of their own was a monumental achievement. It absolutely happened in my family, and in Reimagining Equality, I tell the story of how my grandfather went from being a slave to owning property himself.
Have these issues of equality surrounding the home always been on your mind, or was there something specific that started you thinking about writing this book?
Well, there were the issues of inequality have been on my mind, of course, and I've always thought it's something I teach, especially in the last 13 years since I've been at Brandeis University. There are subjects that I've taught, but I've increasingly thought about a different way to talk about equality and what it means, and as opposed to thinking only about rights, that there is something beyond rights that we've measured and that would measure equality. And so the idea of talking about equality as the finding of home in America has come to me most recently because of the foreclosure crisis and the subprime lending debacles.
But you also say the death of your mother helped inspire this book.
Yes, absolutely, especially the family portion of the book. As I thought about my mother, who was born in 1911, and the arc of her life, the things that she had seen, her movement with her family from Arkansas when she was just a child, escaping racial violence there, but also leaving a home, a fairly substantial farm of 80 acres, and then moving to Oklahoma to start all over again.
And why did they have to leave their home? I've spoken to people who told me that in all cases it was their grandparents. The grandparents had to act as though they didn't own land, even though they did, because if it looked like they were too prosperous, they might be in danger. That was in Arkansas.
Well, in rural Arkansas, my grandparents had homesteaded 80 acres of land. And by all senses, they were doing quite well in many respects. The 80 acres was their home. They built a cabin there. They had each year after they homesteaded the property, plowed and farmed 5 or 6 acres more each year by hand, and they had built a life there. And that was disrupted due to a threat on my grandfather's life. Exactly the nature of the threat, I haven't been able to quite find out. But in fact, it was a real threat, and it was with that threat that they decided to make the move out. I mean, they didn't decide. They were forced, really, to make the move out of Arkansas.
You focus a lot on women in the book. Have they been more severely affected than men?
You mean in the recent...
Or are they in general?
In general, the whole idea of home and how it figures in our sense of equality is not a parallel story with African Americans in terms of the location. But more recently, especially, if we think about how important it was for women to be, at least initially even, to own property in their own name, to be able to own the home that in which they live, or to buy a home on their own, and the laws that discriminated against women in lending.
But women also head the majority of black households now.
Absolutely. And we have to understand, especially in this latest crisis, housing crisis, the impact that the loss of the ability to acquire a safe and secure home has had on African American women has been profound. And in Reimagining Equality, I chronicle many of their stories, the stories leading up to this crisis, and in particular, the story of one woman in Baltimore, Maryland, Baltimore City, Maryland, a hairdresser who owns her own salon, who was struggling with a loan that escalated. Really, her payment for her monthly mortgage payment over doubled, and was at really on the verge of losing her home. And I tell her story not simply because it's one story, and her life story is a very interesting story, but I tell it because it reflects really the stories of so many Americans.
In 2009, the mayor and city council of Baltimore brought a suit against Wells Fargo for targeting inner city prospective home buyers for subprime mortgages. Have the foreclosures on those loans had an impact on the whole city?
The foreclosures in Baltimore have, in fact, impacted individuals, it's impacted communities, and it has impacted the entire city. Resources are being used by the city to try to keep those neighborhoods where the crisis has hit most severely, to keep those neighborhoods safe and secure for those residents who are remaining there.
Well, the city of Memphis and the state of Illinois also sued Wells Fargo. But we've seen foreclosures across the country and in many different communities. Has the subprime mortgage crisis had an outsized impact on the poor and urbanized communities?
Well, I can say that this. They started, really, it's almost as though subprime mortgages and predatory lending started really using these communities and people of color, communities of color, and women, single women, almost as a testing ground. But in fact, we know that the practices of predatory lending and high-cost loans were not limited to people of color or women. It, as I say, it was almost as though that was the testing ground. And then it moved into larger communities and swept across the country. Recently, the state of Nevada has won a suit to try to recover for some of the citizens of the state. In particular, Las Vegas has been hit very hard, but many of the citizens throughout Nevada have been hit by this crisis. And again, it extended, it sort of started in one place and grew and now impacts all of us. And I think people really need to understand, we have been sort of led to believe that the problem is just a limited problem that can be contained. And we know that in fact these practices really brought down an entire financial system in this country and globally.
My guest is Anita Hill. Her latest book, Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home, published by Beacon Press. And you start off each chapter with a different dictionary definition of the word home. How do you define the word?
Well, ultimately, what I would like to define home as, and I see it really as a vision that I have not only for home, but I have for America as a home. And I define it really as a place where one is valued and welcomed, where one can live out their full potential and be nurtured, and where one can make contributions to the outside.
Well, it was interesting to note that there were slight differences between the definitions from each different dictionary. And the implications of that.
The implications, really, not only are there differences in dictionary definitions, but, you know, some of those dictionary definitions came from years past. But think about how differently each individual defines home. So the dictionary differences are one difference, but what I like for people to do when they are, as I say, reimagining equality and reimagining home, I like for them to think about what it means to them and how important it is in their own access to opportunity and the American dream.
Well, some people, you say home, and they'll talk about their neighborhood. Others, they'll talk about where they live. It could be a rental. Or it could be a place that they own. And there are different implications in all of those situations, too.
As a matter of fact, you're right. And I'm not proposing in Reimagining Equality that everyone has to own a home to be equal in this country.
But that was something that we seem to be on the path of not all that long ago. It was actually government policy to make it easier for people to own a home.
Because, in fact, it is so built into our ideas about the American dream. And so it was an appropriate idea for the government to pursue in terms of making people feel that they were a part of this nation. But, in fact, it really, as I say in the book, that American dream is really too important and critical for us to leave to the whims of the housing market.
How did the Great Migration, which started around World War I and ended in the early 1970s, change ideas about home ownership in the black community?
African Americans, as you know, during that migration period, moved from being largely rural individuals owning farms, if they could, to
more sharecropping.
So that they were really, I say in many cases, still living in the shadow of slavery, an old plantation system, and moving to greater opportunity, finding a new home in the northern cities and in some of the western cities.
And Booker T. Washington urged migrating blacks to become model citizens, to buy homes, establish model neighborhoods. Were most blacks able to do that?
Absolutely not. That's the tragedy of it. As Washington was urging us to show our worth and our right to citizenship through the way that we possessed and showed our home, showing our belonging, we were not able to do that because there were so many laws that kept us from doing that. Restrictive covenants in the law, redlining for people who wanted to get loans. It was so prevalent that, in fact, it shaped communities and neighborhoods and continues to do so. The impact is still with us.
Lorraine Hansberry is a Raisin in the Sun. Premiered on Broadway in 1959. It's hard to believe it was that long ago. And that was loosely based on her family's experience in Chicago in the 1930s. Why was housing discrimination particularly prevalent in a northern city like Chicago?
Well, we have this idea that segregation was really only a huge factor in the South. But if you read the stories of individuals and if you follow this particular play in particular, you'll know that absolutely people were being segregated in the North. And that had an impact on our ability to, as they say, move up. And to show to develop assets, to develop wealth in terms of home ownership. And it really, there were some successes. Some successful neighborhoods were established. But as I say, the impact has been long-term. And one of the things that I do in Reimagining Equality is move us through the years, from my grandparents' time, through the time of Lorraine Hansberry, the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and show the connection between all of those factors that inhibited ownership and home building and where we are now.
Well, Martin Luther King Jr. went to Chicago in 1966 because he was making the point that this was not just something that was happening in the South. And he lost that battle, didn't he?
He did largely lose that battle, and it has taken, we're continuing. That's one of the reasons that the state of Illinois has been so hard hit, and the Attorney General in Illinois has brought her suit against the Wells Fargo Bank, in part because of those lingering issues of segregation and the impact that keeping communities closed off to lending opportunities has even today. But I think we have to also think about how our vision of home ownership changed and what home meant. I like to take people to a sort of a cultural icon, a popular cultural icon of, let's say, the Jeffersons, the sitcom in the 1970s. And what we saw was George and Louise Jefferson moving up to the deluxe apartment in the sky as their emblem of success. And it was very interesting because that show could not have happened were it not for the fact that they were African American. But the other interesting aspect of that is that on a gender level, when Louise Jefferson moved up, she became a stay-at-home homemaker. And that was advancement for women.
My guest is Anita Hill, professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University, where she teaches courses on race and the law and gender equality. She, of course, worked as the attorney advisor to Clarence Thomas at the U.S. Department of Education for a while. She's the author of Speaking Truth to Power, which she wrote about her experiences as a witness in the Thomas hearings. She's also written widely on issues of race and gender in publications like the New York Times, Newsweek, the Boston Globe, Ms., and others. And her latest book is called Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. It's published by Beacon Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with an interview I did in October with Anita Hill. Her latest book, Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding a Home, is published by Beacon Press. I brought up a 1965 report called The Negro Family, The Case for National Action, which was written by the sociologist, future New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. It cited the matriarchal structure of black households as one of the things holding black men back. And I asked Anita Hill, how did Moynihan argue that the strength of women in the home was holding men back?
Well, it's hard to believe that was an argument that was made, that strong black women were, in fact, a detriment to African Americans. But it really fed into this myth of women sort of emasculating men and taking away their confidence to go out and work in the world, as opposed to looking at the rampant racial discrimination that both women and men were experiencing.
Although what he was saying is not all that different than you hear in a lot of black churches, where the minister will say that women have to hold back and encourage men to go out there and do more.
In fact, I was in a church. I visited a church once, and that was one of the sermons. I mean, it was the only time I was there, and that was the sermon I was met with when I went. And as I say, that was the only time I went to that church. But it is true that you do hear some of that, but I think that we are now at a different era in our reality. And the reality is that if the African American community is to succeed, we will succeed with the full effort of both men and women.
Well, although Moynihan, you may disagree with him on the matters of gender, wasn't he right on a lot of observations about race and race relations at the time?
I believe he was right in terms of his observations about some of the breakdowns that we were going to be seeing, some of the social backgrounds in the black family. But his policy approach to resolving those issues was, in fact, then very retro, if you will. And, in fact, instead of being more progressive and saying, how do we shore up everybody in the community? And if we shore up everyone in the community, we can all move forward. He simply said, let's take 50% of the community and keep them shut up and stay at home, and that'll cure the problem.
Many people have criticized the Clinton administration's policies to increase national home ownership largely by loosening the restrictions on financing. Do you see that as being one of the big problems?
Loosening the restrictions on financing, in fact, have contributed. But really, when I say restrictions, I really mean regulation of the banks and full disclosure of information to customers and consumers. Those kinds of restrictions were helpful and could have staved off some of the crisis that we are in right now.
Well, this has been a bipartisan effort, hasn't it?
What do you mean it's been a bipartisan? The deregulation.
Well, both Republicans and Democrats have called for the deregulation to encourage home ownership.
Right. Deregulation of banks, in fact, during the Clinton era, was a bipartisan effort. But it really has backfired. And if you'll read in Reimagine Equality, in one of the chapters in particular, Chapter 6, I talk about how everybody, Republican and Democrat, got into this game. And then the banks took it and then really went into a movement of predatory lending and subprime loans that were not good for anyone.
Does it take a crisis like that or Hurricane Katrina to make people even aware of these fault lines?
I hope it doesn't take a crisis. But the fact is, we are now in a crisis. And we can call it a housing market crisis, but I think it's much deeper than that. I call it a crisis of home. And it is a crisis of home because millions of Americans today are insecure about whether or not they're going to be able to afford to even live in their homes. So given that we're in a crisis, it behooves us now to think about how we're going to resolve it and how we're going to prevent it from happening again.
How can the symbolism of the election of President Obama help further equality when it comes to the idea of home? The Obamas as a couple represent different strands of the journey to home ownership.
Absolutely. Michelle Obama's journey to home ownership comes through her slave background in her family, and that's been chronicled. His journey to home really is almost more of a 20th century story of coming to home. It is a story of a white American finding her home, but also of immigrant families moving to America to find home here. And so I think the combination of those two individuals really are hugely symbolic for me in terms of why I think President Obama can lead us in a discussion.
Can he lead us in any discussion these days?
I am ever hopeful. And the reason that I'm hopeful about this particular discussion is because this is really This is a universal concept. Home is not something that's limited to one group or another. It's about all of us.
And you're calling for a home summit. How would that jumpstart a discussion of these issues?
What I call for really is conversations about where we want to be when we get to the other side, conversations about the importance of homes to Americans. And what I do is I actually model it in some ways on the Clinton conversations on race. But a discussion of home allows us to talk not only about race, but also to talk about gender. It gives us a chance to talk about economic equality and inequalities, if you will. It gives us a chance to really talk to everybody, to engage everyone in this conversation, including all of our social leaders, our business leaders, as well as our political leaders.
My guest is Anita Hill. Her latest book, Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home, is published by Beacon. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Has the housing crisis set off another kind of migration? There was a report last week that people are moving out of the Sun Belt. And in recent years, we've read many reports of African Americans moving south again, reversing the Great Migration.
That is happening. We have people moving. Still, we are a country in search of that home. And what I say is that a 21st century, and that's really a 20th century vision of how to find home, and what I say is a 21st century vision of home has to be about how we can make home for people wherever they live so that we don't have to move from one city to the next. We don't have these huge migrations to get to a place where people can live out their dreams.
Well, the South has changed enough, at least in some people's minds, for it to be considered a welcoming place for African Americans again.
It has changed. But when we talk about having to move because where we're leaving is no longer providing us with what we need, what we're saying is that we're going to give up on one area. I don't want to give up on those urban areas because, in fact, they are a part of the history of African Americans. They're a history of American achievement. And so those are critical areas to all of us.
Is it coincidental that this book is being released on the 20th anniversary? I guess tomorrow is the 20th anniversary of the hearings for Clarence Thomas's confirmation.
This is a book that I have been working on for some years now. I'm proud that it is released now. I've been out talking about this book as well as different events. There's one at Hunter College on October 15th, and I'll be talking about my current work as well as what happened 20 years ago. All of this is a part of who I am. And so I don't think that anything really is coincidental. But what I want people to understand is that my life has gone on, my belief in equality continues, and that this book is a result of the larger belief in equality that I really started to interact with, in particular in a public way, in 1991.
When the hearings were over, people did tell you that everything would be forgotten in a couple of months. Are you surprised by how much resonance they continue to have?
I am surprised until I actually read individuals' letters, and I have really over the past 20 years, I suspect I have about 25,000 letters and emails, and I even have telegrams
from
1991. Largely in support,
the overwhelming majority of Supreme Court justices being an exception.
Well, that was clearly not in support. But, you know, I have those as well, and I take all of those into account. And I realize that Mrs. Thomas, that this issue not only resonates with her, but it resonates with a lot of Americans.
Do you think it's because they've tapped into something that wasn't being addressed or still hasn't been addressed? Are these issues still alive and well?
In 1991, we had a chance to talk, women in particular, had a chance to talk about things that had been going on in the workplace for centuries, that we had been told to keep quiet about, that we had been holding secrets. And the ability to finally get those things out and to tell our stories is something that I think was so compelling about that hearing.
Well, do you think that this was about race, as it has come to be thought of, or was it about just sexual harassment, the power of somebody over the people, the women who work for him?
It was, in fact, about power of people over others, whether it be in the workplace, whether it be on the street, or even in the homes. I hear from people of all kinds of backgrounds and experiences that testimony resonated with. People who feel voiceless, people who feel powerless, that they now feel emboldened and more empowered to speak about the truth of their experiences and to challenge those in power.
When you were working with Clarence Thomas at the Department of Education, then later at the Equality Employment Opportunity Commission, did you have any inkling of his political views? Jeffrey Toobin has described him in a recent column in The New Yorker as the most influential justice on the Supreme Court nowadays.
Of course, I had some ideas of what his political views were. I do think that his 20 years on the bench, he has really sharpened and those ideas, and really has become much more adamant and edgier with those ideas, even than he was when I worked with him 30 years ago.
But he was expressing some of those ideas even then. You could pretty much have predicted where he would go.
I believe that, yes, he was really working out those ideas in his time with the EEOC. This was an early part of his career, too, in politics and in law. And those were ideas that he was working on. And as I say, they have really sharpened and hardened, if you will, over time.
What about your ideas over the years?
Well, I have always been a believer in equality. I think now I pursue them with much more urgency than I did in the past. I mean, I really, in 1991, was a law professor in Oklahoma, content to live out my equality ideas through my own experience. I was teaching contracts and commercial law, not subjects that people tend to think of when they think about equality. In fact, I have left part of that experience, and I only get back into it a little bit in the book when I talk about the loans and the banks and those kinds of institutions. So it allows me to tap into that part of my life. But now I teach primarily on issues of equality and how policies can pursue it at Brandeis.
And Anita Hill is a professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University. Her latest book is Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. It is published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure.